Civil Service Commission versus Fred Davis from Bexar County. Webb County Appraisal District and Webb County Appraisal Review Board versus the New Laredo Hotel from Webb County. And Edward Cates Jr. versus Dover Corporation from Bowie County. In between the presentation of each of these arguments, the court will take a brief recess, but we will finish all of these proceedings before we break for the noon recess. Counsel on the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom during other matters, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your argument without delay. Counsel on all causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may listen to the tapes of these arguments by making application with the clerk's office. In the first cause, we have allotted 20 minutes of argument for each side and 5 minutes for rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Fred Jones and Mr. Gilbert Botta will present argument for petitioner. Mr. Jones will open.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Fred Jones, along with Gilbert Botta Jr. We represent the Bexar County Sheriff's Civil Service Commission in this case. The issue before the court in this case is whether a deputy sheriff who has been issued a notice of proposed dismissal is has an opportunity to confront the witnesses against him and present evidence at an administrative hearing is also constitutionally entitled to pre-hearing notice of those accusers. Mr. Vara will address points 2 and 3 in our brief, which are briefly whether the trial court was without jurisdiction to consider this case because of the absence of the Bexar County Sheriff, whom we believe to have been a necessary and indispensable party, without whom relief could not be granted. And thirdly, whether the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to award the commission the reasonable cost of the preparation of the administrative transcript. The facts briefly in this case are that prior to September of 1985, Mr. Fred Davis was a deputy sheriff in the Bexar County Sheriff's Department. On September 16, 1985, Mr. Davis was issued a notice of proposed dismissal from his office as a deputy. He was served with a notice of proposed dismissal that specifically notified him that because of claims of sexual harassment to various members of the female employees of the Sheriff's Department, he was being terminated. The notice of proposed dismissal specifically addressed the rule violations in question and specifically noticed him as to the location where these activities occurred. Mr. Davis was allowed an opportunity to respond. In fact, he did respond both verbally and in writing prior to termination. The sheriff considered his response and went ahead with the order of dismissal, again tracking the facts that were stated in the notice of proposed dismissal, the sexual harassment of female employees of the department. Mr. Davis then appealed to the Bexar County Sheriff's Civil Service Commission pursuant to the Texas Local Government Code. And at that hearing, which lasted about 8 days, Mr. Davis was allowed full confrontation of all of the witnesses at the administrative hearing.
How many witnesses were there?
At the hearing, the sheriff called 14 witnesses and Mr. Davis called 22 witnesses.
How many women testified as to sexual harassment?
Your Honor, I don't recall exactly. I was not present at the hearing, and I can't recall.
What acts of sexual harassment were testified to?
Various acts of sexual harassment, such as touching various parts of the female anatomy, various statements that were made by Mr. Davis about what he would like to do with those female employees, things of that nature. At the commission hearing, Mr. Davis was represented by 3 lawyers. He was allowed full confrontation of the witnesses by the sheriff before he presented his case.
But he was given no idea of who would be testifying against him until he showed up at the hearing.
That is correct, Your Honor. He was given
what due process is that?
Your Honor, the question is what process is due and when is that process due? And it is the commission's position that the process that is due is a reasonable opportunity to present evidence and to confront witnesses at the administrative hearing. And the federal precedent on this point is that pre-hearing notice of accusers is not required.
Well, what federal precedent is there that says that?
the Wells versus Dallas Independent School District case that is cited in our brief specifically addresses that question.
Isn't the federal authority that the Court of Appeals relied upon subject to interpretation that it requires, as the Court of Appeals said, some pre-hearing notice of the accusers and the witnesses?
Your Honor, the decision of the Court of Appeals, while we believe correctly states the facts and is 90% correct, did not cite any authority in support of its position that pre-hearing notice of accusers is required. In fact, there is no state case on point on that particular issue. The federal precedent is to the contrary. At the hearing, again, Mr. Davis was allowed full confrontation. After the hearing, the commission decided to uphold the decision of the sheriff and affirm the dismissal of Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis then appealed to the district court, and at the district court, all of the transcripts of the administrative hearing, all of the witnesses who testified, their testimony was transcribed and presented in the form of exhibits to the trial court. And Judge Carolyn Spears accepted those exhibits and that testimony, reviewed that testimony, and in addition had live testimony from certain witnesses, after which Judge Spears found that the decision of the commission was reasonably supported by substantial evidence, and two, that the notice provisions substantially complied with all requirements of the law.
Is there a discovery procedure in hearings before the commission?
No, Your Honor.
Is there a subpoena procedure?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Davis was allowed to exercise the subpoena power of the administrative body. The trial court found that the decision should be upheld. Mr. Davis then appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals, while as I have said, basically correctly decided almost every issue in the case, made the extraordinary holding that prior to a hearing in a civil service context, the employee is entitled to notice of the accusers. The Court of Appeals reversed and remanded the case to the trial court with instructions to remand it to the commission to hold another hearing that would be procedurally correct. And the Court of Appeals did not, and specifically did not, address the question whether the decision of the commission was reasonably supported by substantial evidence. In other words, the Court of Appeals did not utilize the traditional test of is this decision supported by substantial evidence. It just said that the notice provisions as applied in this particular case would not pass constitutional scrutiny.
Well, after the hearing that was given had been held, what kind of requirements are your statutory required or required by your internal rules for post-termination review?
Yes.
And for appellate right?
Yes. The commission has basically adopted the Cleveland Board of Education versus Loudermill decision, which says that it's a 1985 Supreme Court case that says that in the case of a property right, where an employee has a property right in his continued employment, which we concede in this case that Mr. Davis had, that under those circumstances, what is required is to give the employee notice of the proposed action, the general nature of the evidence supporting that accusation, and an opportunity to respond prior to termination. And then coupled with post-termination, an administrative hearing at which time the employee is entitled to confront his witnesses and cross-examine the witnesses and present his case in chief. In Texas, there is no case law on this issue, but the Supreme Court of the United States has, in a series of cases, addressed this, some of the questions that we're dealing with here today. Really, there are two questions that we're dealing with. First of all, was Mr. Davis entitled to pre-termination evidentiary hearing? And we submit that the cases of Goldberg versus Kelly, which is a 1970 United States Supreme Court case, and the Loudermill case, which is a 1985 case, directly hold that pre-termination there is no requirement for the government to have an evidentiary hearing. And the court had reasoned that it is not required because at that point it would be an unwarranted intrusion on the government's interest in removing an unsatisfactory employee. It's only after the termination that the employee is entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Goldberg versus Kelly is a little bit of an unusual case in this context in that it did require a pre-termination hearing. But you have to look at the unusual facts of Goldberg versus Kelly, because in that case we were dealing with, the Supreme Court was dealing with pre-termination hearing of welfare benefits of citizens of the city of New York.
Does it matter whether there's a civil service system in place in public employment?
Yes, Your Honor. Prior to the adoption of the Civil Service Commission rules in Bexar County, deputies served at the pleasure of the sheriff and could only maintain an action against the sheriff if the deputy was somehow defamed in his termination. Only then would he be entitled to a name-clearing type of hearing.
What civil service system applies here?
The Civil Service Commission was established pursuant to Section 158 of the Texas Local Government Code. It's a civil service commission designed specifically for sheriff's departments.
And is that all in Bexar County or is it statewide?
It's statewide. And then the by local option is applied in Bexar County, and Bexar County has adopted its own rules governing how the commission will work.
Are they in any way similar to the civil service protection set out for municipal employees?
Yes.
Police officers in Article 12, Section 19?
Yes, they are, Your Honor. The Loudermill case, as I've said, has directly held that what process is due is the question to be answered. What process is due pre-termination and then post-termination? And you have to look at both of those procedures. And the courts have said that more than this would intrude to an unwarranted extent on the governmental agencies. There's also a very direct case, a case that's directly in point, and that is the case that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and that's Wells versus Dallas Independent School District. In this case, the assistant superintendent of a Dallas, of one of the schools, found out on TV that he had been discharged. And the court in that case said it's only when an employee is not allowed to be present at the administrative hearing that he is entitled to notice of his witnesses and notice of who his accusers are. Only when the employee is not allowed to be present at that administrative hearing. The court specifically said that a discharged employee who is present at the administrative hearing, who sees and hears the witnesses against him, has notice of who they are and what they maintain before he must produce his witnesses and his case. In this particular case, there was a substantial period of time for Mr. Davis to prepare his case. He had three lawyers. This extended over about the last week of December of 1985.
Do you think there's any distinction to be drawn under the fact that Mr. Wells was not covered by the Civil Service Protection of Article 12, Section 9M, which you have conceded that Mr. Davis was here?
Your Honor, I don't think there's a distinction to be made there. The court dealt with the issue of what is required for a governmental employee to be terminated, who has a protected property interest. The only thing that the only thing that the civil service status does for Mr. Davis is provide him with that property interest that the Wells court discussed. So it makes no distinction. Basically, it is our position that Mr. Davis received all the process that was due. I would like to yield the remainder of my time to Mr. Vada to discuss the remaining points.
Under the Loudermill case, if you'd given him no notice at all, he would not have been afforded due process, right?
That is right.
And does Loudermill describe what the notice needs to contain?
The Loudermill case talks about the notice in general terms of what the evidence is going to be. It does not say that the employee is entitled to know names, places, dates, locations, that sort of thing. Does not address that.
Thank
you. How many women testified as to sexual harassment?
Well, Your Honor, it's my understanding of the record that five women testified as to the elements of the sexual harassment, which were specified in the notice of proposed dismissal. Briefly, it's Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 13, Your Honor. And in that particular exhibit, they discussed specific statements of sexual encounters, such as grabbing, fondling, rubbing,
adding even to the date of the actual act, September 13th, 1985, and even listed certain relationships with other employees of the Sheriff's Department in which these acts might have taken place. The important issue, I believe, that Justice Doggett raises is critical to this court's understanding. And at first blush, it appears that due process would encompass a severe number of requirements on the government. And it seems to me that in looking at the Wells case, looking at the Arnett versus Kennedy case, looking at the Goldberg case, and looking at the Loudermill case, we're looking at what due process is required to be accorded to a discharged employee. Under the Wells case, it is clear that the distinction was made by the Fifth Circuit as to what process was due to someone who is present at the hearing. In the Wells case, the court was confronted with someone who was present, who saw the witnesses, had an opportunity to cross-examine, and at that time, the court determined he was ready to present his case in chief. They made the distinction between someone who is not present at the hearing and cited a case called Dixon versus Alabama, which is also cited in our brief. The Dixon case is an interesting case because it involved a civil rights demonstration on a campus in 1961. The court held that where the school went ahead and expelled these students without a hearing, that they were entitled to more due process. They were entitled to a list of the names of the witnesses, a written or oral statement of what the charges were, an opportunity to confront them. In other words, a reasonable substitute for what was presented to someone who was at a hearing. And
do you agree with your co-counsel that deputy sheriffs under this system are entitled to the same due process and other substantive protections that municipal police officers enjoy under Article 1269M?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the statutes, and I don't mean to evade the question, but to the extent that the statutes are similar, yes, they do, but the statutes are specifically tailored to certain due process rights. In other words, the commission has very limited powers, very limited authority.
And don't you think that those cases which have construed Article 1269 and would be more persuasive than federal cases involving federal?
Well, to the extent that the police department cases and the fireman cases have not construed this issue, I don't see, Your Honor, how they would be more persuasive. The issue really is whether or not the fact-finding process of the administrative decision is protected, because that's really the underlying rationale behind having an efficient, informal administrative process. What the respondents would like to do is create a situation in which discovery takes place, in which there's access to investigative reports, in which there is deposition testimony available. And it's clear that under the Civil Service Commission statutes, that there is a rule which allows the compelling of witnesses and the compelling of production. And in this particular case, Mr. Davis was accorded those opportunities. He was accorded the opportunity for continuance. He was accorded the opportunity to cross-examine. He was accorded the opportunity to call additional witnesses. It seems to me, Your Honor, that under the federal precedent, the issue really is this the process due, not whether the maximum process should be provided. And again, the underlying rationale behind that is simply that in this process, it is an informal process in which the rules of civil procedure and the rules of evidence are not imposed on a lay body. And the reason for this, Your Honor, I think is basically that the government's interest in these proceedings is very different from the government's interest in a regular civil case or in a criminal case. In this particular case, we had an individual charged not with simply a mistake on an application for employment. Here is a situation involving harassment. And so the government had specific interests in not only employee discipline and morale, but certainly in making sure that the operations within that department were run efficiently, that there was effective discipline and operation within that department. And then, of course, more importantly, and the issue that will be directed to you by the respondents, that those unnamed witnesses were protected as a result of, you know, as a result of of their coming, excuse me, forward with testimony to the district attorney's office. So those government interests are critical, and the administrative fact-finding process is also critical.
What harm can be done to the government by allowing all the due process that the person who's accused wants to have?
Well, that was addressed clearly, Your Honor, in the Loudermill case as to whether or not this would be an unwarranted intrusion. And the court directly said that the government is not required to do that, because those types of administrative delays would reduce the operations of the fact-finding body, would turn what would normally be an efficient process into an inefficient process, and would not allow the government to remove those individuals who are in fact dangerous or unsatisfactory employees. So I would argue that is the government interest that's involved. That would be the government interest that would be in...
Yeah, but it's so easy for fellow employees if they decide to get you or make up all kinds of stories, lots of gossip, whatever. You bring all that to a lay body, and then you know, the guy gets terminated.
Well, that's exactly right, Ron.
Rumor.
And that's exactly why it is necessary to have the subsequent termination evidentiary hearing for the counsel representing that employee to do the cross-examination necessary to call the witnesses and subpoena those witnesses to impeach the testimony of those individuals. But especially in a case involving sexual harassment, the testimony of those employees against Mr. Davis would not have been obtained and probably would not be obtained in future cases unless their identities were protected, especially in situations in which the administrative agency has a duty to run an efficient process.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that. They didn't come in and testify without identity at the time of the hearing, did they?
That's correct. And Your Honor, that's why the court in Wells says that an individual is entitled to be told once what the evidence is and what the evidence, what the support is for those allegations, not twice.
Well, I suppose that they knew in these days and day and time that they might end up in a lawsuit just like they did here. I don't understand why you're disclosing their names in advance of the hearing in the notice or in subsequent writing involves any interference with governmental operations or reduces the chance that you'll get those witnesses to come forward.
Well, Your Honor, specifically in this particular case, the supervisors who was involved, Mr. Davis, politically was part of a prior administration, and that was why this issue was so sensitive. At that time, there was fear from the employees of retaliation, not only by Mr. Davis, but by other supervisors in that department under which they worked. And that was the issue, I think, that faced the Sheriff's Department as to whether to disclose. I have a very limited amount of time, and I would like to...
So you don't have any time at all?
Oh, I don't have any
time. Let me ask you a question. At that hearing, did Mr. Davis was present?
Yes, he was at the administrative hearing, yes.
And he had the benefit of counsel. He had three attorneys. Did they participate and cross-examine the witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor. He had a benefit of counsel from the time the notice of proposed dismissal was issued through his response through the evidentiary hearing all the way to where we are.
Were the witnesses cross-examined?
Yes, they were.
Did he have a right to ask for continuance?
Yes, he did.
Did he call any witnesses on his behalf?
Yes, he did.
And how long was the hearing?
The hearing lasted 8 days.
8 days?
Yes, Your Honor. The transcript alone, excuse me, the bill on the transcript alone is over $6,000 at the commission hearing.
That's the post-termination?
That's correct, Your Honor, the subsequent evidentiary hearing, subsequent to the order of dismissal.
How long did the pre-dismissal hearing run?
Well, and that's important that the court understand, there was no pre-termination hearing. Under Loudermill, that's not a requirement in discharged government employee cases. There was an opportunity for Mr. Davis to meet with the Sheriff's Department to respond orally, which he did, as well as in writing with his counsel's aid.
And how long did that, that's what I meant, how long did that proceed?
I really don't know. There's not a record of that, Your Honor.
How much later was the full-fledged evidentiary hearing?
The notice of proposed dismissal was September 16th. Mr. Davis was dismissed September 23rd, 1985. The commission hearings were December 23rd, 1985. Mr. Davis perfected his appeal to the commission on September 30th, so I would say, Your Honor, about 2.5 months.
And what date did he first learn the names of the accused?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Davis first learned the names of those individuals who would testify against him at the hearing.
On December?
December 30th, 1985, 30th. Yes, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
Doesn't the need to conduct discovery at a hearing like this actually prolong it if you don't know who the witnesses are going to be?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. What sense?
You need discovery before the hearing because you don't know who the witnesses will be. Doesn't the government actually have these hearings prolonged and have more inefficiency by a prolonged hearing in creating a situation where opposing counsel has to conduct his discovery during the hearing?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. In this particular case, the number of witnesses that were called were every person, almost every person that had any direct contact with these women. The additional discovery of depositions, researching the investigative reports prepared by the District Attorney's Office, which in essence were never even shown to the court, that I think would have taken a considerable amount of time away from the hearing and would have prolonged the hearing as opposed to just cross-examining them at the evidentiary hearing.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Have no rebuttal. No rebuttal time. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Harry Nass, open the argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Harry Nass, Jr., along with Mr. Charles Butts and Bobby Wilman from San Antonio. It's our privilege and pleasure to represent Captain Fred Davis, who was more than just a deputy sheriff, with 17 years of experience in law enforcement in Bexar County, and was the chief of our warrant section, a very critical portion of the sheriff's office, in our opinion. I would like to answer some of these things that have arisen and questions that the court today. My recollection of the record is that there was four women testified. We were down there in the trench. We didn't know who these women were going to be until they got on the stand and started giving evidence. The hearing didn't last 8 days. It lasted a portion of 8 days. We'd have some hearings in the afternoons for a while, adjourned to a later date. It was piecemeal. From the very time that plaintiff's exhibit number one was first shown to Captain Fred Davis, if you look in the record, plaintiff's exhibit number 13, which is the notice of dismissal, there are no names of any individual given who is going to give evidence of harassment. There's one point that I would like to straighten out, and if the court can't do nothing else for us, would you please do this? The charge names a lady by the name of Debbie Windler. From the Court of Appeals opinion, one gets the impression that Debbie Windler was an employee of the sheriff's office. The record reflects she was not then, nor has she ever been, an employee of the sheriff's office in Bexar County.
Would that make a difference who you sexually harass? It's okay to harass people who are non-employees?
Well, in answer to that question, you see, Debbie Windler doesn't testify. So there's no evidence of any harassment as far as Debbie Windler's concerned. So I come along with Mr. Butts and Mr. Wilman, and we're trying to figure out, you know, who's going to ambush us next. How are we going to be dry gulched? And, you know, I got to thinking about it on the way down here. If I walked into a district court with a pleading that said the defendant committed an act of negligence, and I said the defendant, I don't know a trial judge in Texas who wouldn't grant a defendant special exception and at least make them tell us the names. I think we're entitled to that.
You guys see a difference between those type of actions and administrative proceedings?
No, because it's basic, fundamental fairness and notice. If I get indicted for murder, they got to tell me who I killed, and they got to tell me how I did it. If I'm charged with robbery, they got to tell me who I robbed.
So you're asking this court to mandate the full panoply of rights that a criminal defendant has to mandate those types of rights in these hearings. Is that what you're asking us to do?
I'm asking the court to say that a man is entitled to notice of his accusers in an administrative proceeding.
Are you saying that before the first, the Court of Appeals opinion seems to blend these two hearings, for lack of a better word, and so to some of the...
I understand the court's problem.
Maybe I'm just not understanding. Are you saying you're entitled to the notice of the witnesses before the initial termination, or simply at some point between September 23rd and December 30th, so that you can prepare for this full-blown evidentiary hearing?
I suppose, Mr. Chief Justice, what I'm saying is that we ought to have them prior to the hearing. We ought to have them at the time that the sheriff gives us notice of dismissal.
Okay, but when you say the word hearing, you mean the first hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean all of them. Because we haven't got any notice prior.
This court is, we're obviously not bound by Loudermill because this is brought solely under the Texas Constitution. Is it advisable under procedural due process that we follow what the U.S. Supreme Court has laid out under its due process clause in applying our own due course provision.
I have a case here in my notes that I wanted to cite the court to concerning that very matter. It's LaCroix versus Hanlon in 713 Southwest, second 335, pages 338-339, wherein Justice Spears stated state constitutions can and often do provide additional rights for their citizens. This court has been in the mainstream of this movement. The quote that I particularly refer to is about two columns long. And I'd like to call the court's attention to another source, the Texas Bill of Rights, James C. Harrington, Butterworth Legal Publishers, Austin, Texas, 1987, particularly pages 103, which has a beautiful discussion of Article 1, Section 19, which is our state due process clause, which states that Section 19 confers affirmative rights directly on the people and is not limited to restricting government activity, as is the 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment, for that matter. Secondly, Section 19 expands due process protection beyond life, liberty, property, privileges, and immunities to exclude in any manner in which a citizen may be disenfranchised. Now, as I understand the law, and my understanding is not always correct, but I know you're going to straighten me out on that, that under Article 1, Section 19 of the Constitution of Texas, and under the judicial provision, this court has the authority to interpret Section 19, and this court has the authority to do what it thinks is fit, right, and proper under these circumstances from a state constitutional standpoint. And as I understand Justice Spears' opinion, he says the federal constitution is the bottom line, the state constitution is the top line. Now, one thing I would like to suggest to the court, and one thing I don't understand about this case. There is a case that I think is directly in point under civil service, old 1269M. It's not 1269M, it's in the government code because the West Publishing Company wanted to get some more money out of the lawyers at Texas, I presume, and the legislature went along with it. The City of San Antonio versus Poulos, 422 Southwest 2nd, page 140, where this court said in 1967 at page 145, if the department head is going to fire an officer for having in his possession a stolen gun which he failed to report, then the department head ought to be able to allege those facts and make proof thereof. Now, the facts that are not alleged here is what are the ladies' names that we're supposed to have harassed, so that we as lawyers can do our sworn duty and know who to subpoena. How can we check their backgrounds to find out whether or not their reputations for truth and veracity is good, bad, or indifferent?
Mr. Mass, during the 8 day part of days, if you had any time, ask for a continuance, you could do the very thing you're talking about?
After the fact was the only opportunity. We should have had the opportunity to do that before the hearing commenced.
I understand that's your argument, but I'm saying during the hearing, if you had any time, ask for a continuance, so you could do subpoena any witnesses?
During the breaks, yes. Besides going to every district court in Bexar County, here, there, and yonder, and what have you. My whole point, I think, Justice Gonzalez, is this, is if a man walks into my office and he's about to lose his right to make a living, which is a constitutionally protected property right, and a man who, in my opinion, is a capable, competent man, as Ranger Captain John Wood even came and testified as to Captain Davis's capabilities and qualifications. Then, when I walk in to the termination hearing, I ought to be prepared. If I come down here to make an argument before this court or walk into some JP or wherever I go, I think I ought to have some idea as to what I'm going to be confronted with and what I'm going to be talking about.
Are you challenging the evidence? Are you saying that there's no substantial evidence, or are you just mainly saying there were some procedural
Oh, I would say this. If there's no notice, there's no evidence. Certainly not substantial evidence.
Is there anything in the administrative record that reflects what would have been presented or what witnesses would have been called had there been notice or any other further opportunity to do so?
There is none.
I was a little confused, and I don't have the notice here, though I certainly will be looking at it, with what you said about Debbie Wimmer. Was she mentioned in the original notice?
Yes, and you've got to look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 13.
Right. I see that the Court of Appeals reference to that, but that's the notice that you got of this eight partial days hearing, right?
13. Plaintiff's Exhibit 13.
And that's the only notice you have.
Right.
Is her name mentioned as one of the people that, or as a person who was...
Yeah, number one says, while he's employed as a captain in a criminal investigation, between the dates of 1982 and 83, your association with former Deputy Sheriff Alvin Johnson led to numerous sexual encounters with one Debbie Brown Wendler in your office in the Bexar County Courthouse during regular duty.
You got notice of the very kind of thing that you're complaining about today, just that the person you got notified that you harassed or your client harassed didn't show up to testify, but four of the people did.
There's no evidence.
Well, let me be sure that...
There's no evidence that Debbie Wendler ever gave any evidence before any commission.
But you did in the original notice then get advised of the name of one person who it was claimed your client harassed.
That's correct.
Suppose Ms. Wendler had testified, does that make any difference? There were
Might
four
have.
Others that were not named that testified.
Might have. I can't
does that
answer.
Make a difference in your argument about notice? If the named person had testified.
All right. I would have at least had an opportunity to go out and to investigate and bring evidence before the commission that Debbie Wendler was a common prostitute.
Is that what you said about the other four?
How did I know what to say about the other four? I couldn't check them out beforehand.
Did you say that about the other four?
If you will look at an exhibit that was introduced in evidence, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, it's a picture of a cake, but it depicts a little custom. When a lady had a birthday in the sheriff's office, she was given one of these cakes, which, for want of a better description, directs a penis in an erect state, which was made at a local cake shop. We were able to cast certain dispersions and to develop some things, but not what we feel that we were constitutionally guaranteed. That's the problem. In other words, they say, oh yeah, you got confrontation and you got cross-examination. Sure, we got trial by dry gulch and ambush. And that's our position. Did the court have another question?
No, I was waiting for you to answer mine. You never did. Did you accuse the four women of being prostitutes?
No.
Do you have any constitutional right in a criminal trial to notice of all the witnesses? The state will present against them.
It's Article 2020 of Texas Code of Criminal Procedure gives us the right to require the district attorney to endorse names of witnesses on the indictment. Who appeared and gave evidence before the grand jury. And under the Brady-Giles line of decisions, we have the right to discover anything that is favorable to the accused. And maybe that's what we're getting into here.
Favorable to the accused, how about favorable to the
state? I'm sorry, I did not hear
that. How about favorable to the state?
My Constitution and my reading thereof does not say that the state gets a fair trial. It talks about the accused.
No, but the accused have the right to discover anything, to discover everything that's favorable to the state under Texas criminal.
Well, I would think certainly he would. Certainly he would. Most district attorneys that I encounter, they're anxious to convince me they've got a case, so that I'll go and try to talk the guy into copping out.
I understand, I'm talking about constitutional or statutory law.
Favorable to the state? Under Amendment Number 6, it has always been my position as an attorney, it is my decision to see and then decide for my client what is beneficial to the accused or what might be beneficial to him.
Counsel, one point I'm not really clear about, and that is when he asked for the names of the accusing witnesses, I assume that was done formally. And
many letters are in this record.
Was Captain Davis still working at the sheriff's office in supervision over the women that were going to testify against him?
Not after the date of discharge, which was the 23rd day of December.
Well, is that the date of the notice?
The notice is, excuse me. The notice is dated September 16th, 1985.
But he continued to work there between September and the end of December?
No, he was discharged prior to that.
The time the notice was given, he was out. Is that correct?
Right.
So that there was no fear that he would, in a supervisory capacity, intimidate the supposed witnesses that might be named?
That's correct. That's in my opinion. That's my recollection of the record.
I need to know the facts.
That's my recollection of the record. If I might address the other issues here as to the necessary parties. But I think that Poulos case is so critical because that's a 1269M case that I feel it backs up our position as far as notice is concerned.
Court of Appeals disagreed with you on that, though, didn't they?
They didn't say anything about Poulos.
I thought they did. But they said it wasn't applicable.
Well, if Poulos doesn't apply, it's because it's two different statutes. And they keep talking about Wells. Wells is a 42-1983 case. But before my time runs out...
Is it your contention that he's entitled to the names of everyone that would testify, or just some of those?
When it says several female employees have officially filed written sworn statements wherein they describe their feeling of being sexually harassed and intimidated, I think we're entitled to the names of the individuals that they intend to use. I think that's a very, very modest request that's couched in constitutionally required information. I don't see any problem with that at all.
Poulos is not a constitutional case, though, is it?
Sir?
Poulos is not a constitutional case. It's a statutory case.
Poulos is a 1269M case, which involves a constitutional principle. But the Supreme Court of Texas in 1967, when they wrote Poulos, didn't have Loudermilk.
Well, we don't need Loudermilk if Poulos is decided under our state constitution.
Well, it follows state constitutional, or what I at least feel are state constitutional principles. If I might address the second issue, we take the position that the sheriff is not a necessary party under the provisions of Texas Rule of Civil Procedure Rule 39 because relief can be granted through the courts and through the commission. We take the position further that under the provisions of 158.037 of the Government Code Appeals, an employee who on final decision by the commission is demoted or suspended or removed, he may appeal. He is the only person who may appeal. The sheriff may not appeal. The sheriff is not necessary. The commission under 158.035 has the authority over disciplinary actions. Another thing.
In our judgment, if you were to win in drafting our judgment, who would you order to do what?
The commission.
To do what?
To order reinstatement and full back pay.
Order the commission to order reinstatement.
Order the sheriff to reinstate. Yes.
If he would be reinstated, he could never be tried again, could he not, because of Commission Rule 917 that says...
Back to those courts. As to whether or not he did receive a trial did not receive a hearing having been given notice. I see that coming already. Does that answer the court's question?
Do you think that victims have rights too?
Under the Constitution? I have serious doubts. Because you're not locking up the victims, you're locking up the accused. And it has been my privilege to stand in these courts in this state for 34 years to stand up for the rights of the accused, for working them. In this case, the captain and the sheriff's office. My time's up. Thank you.
Do you reject the balance that the Loudermilk court discussed in Wells to some extent about the right of...
Am I green or am I red?
We can trump the red.
Sure.
We can't.
That's the I'll go for that.
Do you reject the balance that they talk about the need for a quick governmental decision so long as this post-termination hearing is fair because of the need to remove that the government operate with certain employees who are not dangerous or disruptive or incompetent?
The first thing is, you know, I don't see a man like Fred Nagus as a danger. I don't see that he's disruptive. I mean, all they had to do was tell us who our accusers were instead of telling us you don't get any pre-trial discovery. That's all they had to do. So simple.
Any other questions? Thank you,
counsel. Fred asked me to play thank you to the court.
Your Honor, in my brief time remaining, I would like to address some of the statements made by the respondent. First of all, for the court's edification, the volume I have in front of me represents the first volume of the facts that's in the record before this court. This portion is in the facts, which I know you can't see very well, but this portion of the statement of facts represents the testimony of the four witnesses, and I stand corrected, the four witnesses who represent the unnamed female employees with the Bexar County Sheriff's Department who did testify against Mr. Davis.
You say they represent?
I meant the testimony represent, this portion of the transcript.
They were testifying on their own.
That's correct. That is correct.
About their own experience.
That is correct.
Not about what somebody else told them.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is it correct that your notice told them of one person and that she didn't come but four other people did?
Well, it is correct to say that the notice of proposed dismissal named Debbie Brown Windler, not an employee of the Bexar County Sheriff's Department, as well as several other unnamed employees. That is a correct statement of what the notice says. In addition to statements about allegations, as well as a reference to an employee, one Alvin Johnson, of the Sheriff's Department, who it is alleged there was a relationship with Mr. Davis on these occasions in which the offenses occurred. Excuse me?
Was he a witness?
You know, I don't recall at this time. I don't
mentioned in the notice?
He is mentioned in the notice, yes, Your Honor. In addition, I'd like to answer a few other questions the court mentioned. First of all, the case that I've cited in our briefs, the Weatherford versus Bercy case, although a federal United States Supreme Court case does hold that there is no general constitutional right to discovery in criminal cases. And one of the things that I think that is important for the court to understand, and I'm sure the court has taken an awareness of it by the questions, is that there are different classes of due process that we're dealing with. It's a seductive proposition to say that the commission should provide all the process, the maximum amount of process, that it should extend beyond the federal guidelines and the federal guidelines that are found in the various Supreme Court cases. But the fact is that in different situations, you're going to have to apply different principles of due process. And as Mr. Nash raised in his argument, it certainly would be different in a murder case, and it certainly would be different in a civil case argued to this court. You would never want to go into a situation in which your pleadings were different and you didn't have the opportunity to discovery, and the conditions are different in those situations.
Counsel, let me ask you a question at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
I hate to try to oversimplify a matter by asking about what category is this in, but is this a criminal case, or is it a civil case, or is it an administrative case?
This is an administrative case. It is not a criminal case.
To what extent, in your opinion, does the protections of criminal law and procedure apply to this administrative hearing?
Your Honor, it's the position of the Commission that none of the rules of criminal procedure or the rules of criminal evidence apply at all to this procedure. The reason being that this is not a situation in which a criminal indictment has been handed down, a criminal information. In fact, the case law has been exactly the opposite, that a general charge is sufficient to notify Mr. Davis of the charges in front of him. In fact, it's not as if this particular issue has not been addressed in other cases. The dissent in the Loudermilk case, and while this court isn't bound by the Loudermilk case, the dissent in that particular case embodies the position that Mr. Davis said. And the judge actually goes so far as to say, I think that they're entitled to this type of notice of accusers prior to pre-hearing. That is not the position that the Commission takes, and it is also not the law.
Counsel, it's my understanding that you can't even expel a student from school without telling what he did wrong.
That's correct.
If they're accusers, then who the accusers are.
And that's a very important point, but the difference is that in a school case, you have school procedures that are set up different from that in a commission case.
And that's
correct, Your Honor. And in the Dixon versus Alabama case, which is a case which you might be thinking about, is a case in which the court specifically held that if you're not present at the hearing, you are entitled to a number of other protections. A reasonable opportunity to substitute your presence at the hearing with a list of the names of the accusers, an opportunity for a statement, review a statement from the witnesses, a completely different set of circumstances.
After Mr. Davis received his notice of termination, did he make a formal request for the names of the four witnesses?
Your Honor, Mr. Davis did so. He made requests. Excuse me. He made requests not only in his response to the notice of proposed dismissal, but throughout the process from the time he was notified of proposed dismissal through the evidentiary hearing, through the trial court, all along the way.
The names of the four people that were listed on his notice of termination were never furnished to him.
That is correct. They were not furnished prior to the evidentiary hearing.
Is there any we're not talking constitutional now, but is there any policy reason once he was terminated for the Sheriff's Department not releasing those names?
Well, first of all,
is this an individual decision you make in each and every case? Or?
Well, no, I don't think it's.
Is it a policy?
I think it definitely is a policy reason. Well, first of all, of course, we represent the commission and we don't represent the Sheriff's Department. But by analogy, the policy is that the government should be entitled to an efficient administrative process. That's why the rules of civil procedure don't apply.
Would have slowed things down.
That's correct.
More than 3 months if he'd known me then.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the federal cases make great issue of delay, 2 years delay, 3 years delay in these hearings.
3 months isn't exactly rapid fire.
Well, that's true, but when you consider the amount of process that we've given Mr. Davis over the last 5 years, I think it's...
Did they ask for the name for the purpose of taking their deposition?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and that's addressed by the different points of errors raised in the Court of Appeals. The pre-termination hearing, right to investigative report, and on and on.
Now, you concede that there is constitutional dimension to this pre-termination notice. No question about that.
No question about that.
It has to provide notice of...
Absolutely.
And so the first fight is, does it do it when the names aren't in there? And you
that's
claim
correct.
That the case is not.
Well, that's right.
But then there's some other constitutional dimension to the post-termination hearing.
That's correct. There's no question about that. In fact, the Court of Appeals struggled with that in their opinion. And what they ended up saying was that the notice passed the requirements of Loudermill, and the rules passed the requirements of Loudermill. But as applied to Mr. Davis, they felt it was constitutionally infirm.
Any other questions?
Thank you,
counsel. Thank you. That concludes the argument of the first clause. The court will now take a break for session.
The audience, please rise.